Content warning. This episode of The Tide contains references to mutilation and to the death of a minor.
The Tide. Awake, or at least it feels that way. Just like the dreams you've had before, it always feels real initially. And like those, you can see almost nothing around you. There is the wall, bare wooden planks, slightly rotted along one side, scratched along the other in poor repair. You are staring at the corner of this apartment that you've broken into. Before you get the chance to move around, you hear two voices. The first, Ian's, calling again.
Russell.
And the other, Morgan's, saying,
don't go to him.
Is Morgan's coming from the bathroom?
Yes. Certainly sounds like it's coming much closer.
Roll out of bed.
Oh, you're not in bed, you're kind of standing looking at the wall.
Oh.
That's how you always seem to start these dreams.
Oh, interesting. I turn around.
You turn around, you see the apartment pretty much as you left it. The bed sort of shabby on one side. Your coat, I believe you were using as like a blanket.
Yeah.
It's sort of strewn off to one side of the mattress. And in the door frame of the bathroom stands a figure who steps forward, and you recognise Morgan.
I reach over and grab my coat and put it on, almost sort of getting down to business.
Yeah.
Shrug my shoulders on, and...
It doesn't instil any warmth in you when you do it, but as a symbolic gesture, it certainly probably makes you feel a little more confident.
That's what Casey said.
What?
Don't go to Ian. He said don't listen to the voices.
I wonder what he knew. I mean, all I meant was, every time I've had these dreams, we always hear Ian calling to me.
Yeah.
And as soon as you go to wherever he is, you've normally only got a minute or so before the dream ends.
Yeah.
And we're here to do a job.
We need a little longer than that, I think.
Yeah. So just put it out of your mind.
Russell.
Yeah. I'll do my best, eh? I ain't had quite as much experience as you of this locale.
You'll pick it up. Don't worry. First things first, we got to get around to the front of the cafe. See if we've hit on the right memory.
I look out the window. I imagine there's not a lot of vision.
Very, very little. You can see the road of the waterfront and the pavement on the other side. And then before you even get to the railing that would separate the beach from the road, there is fog just obscuring your vision all the way along.
And that would be enough if all we needed was to see the collision.
Yeah, the road's in front of you.
But I'm not convinced. And I lean over to Morgan and say, whatever glass was smashed, it might not even have been in the collision. You reckon we need to get a better angle?
I reckon we need to get down there and see what we can see.
Hang on. Just wind it back as I cross the room and start walking to the stairs.
Sure, you're heading to the door to lead outside, yeah.
I say, what do you mean the right memory?
Every time I come in these dreams, normally it's at home. There's always something happening. Like Rena on the phone with her mum.
Yeah, but it's not always the same.
No. And I don't think I get to choose. I see different stuff every time. You must have had that.
I've experienced it more like a widening. It's been different, but I guess I only had two dreams like this.
Mm.
So the first one had Ian, and the second one had Ian and...
Yeah, it took me a while to realise there were things to see other than Ian. I imagine you had the same feeling.
Yeah. Yeah.
Morgan nods and says, all right, let's make a move. You head outside, opening the door. Initially, you sort of begin moving kind of stealthily, you and Morgan, and then you realize there's probably not any need. This isn't really happening.
I think once we realize, I'll turn back on the stairs and say, "This is ridiculous. Like, I'm going to keep reminding us that this is ridiculous."
You can say it all you want. It's happening.
Yeah, no, it just helps with the fog and the darkness and the, you know?
Yeah, I know. Oh, that reminds me. You haven't looked up yet, have you? Remember I was telling you about the sky?
I look up.
You look up at the sky, squinting through the fog to the void above, absent of all points of light. And yet, there is movement. Variations or shades within the darkness. They swirl, shift, and ripple, though it's hard to tell exactly what they are. They collapse and form without any discernible pattern, and it's only after a few moments of concentration that you recognize the shapes. Your eyes follow the distant silver light, filtering down through the sky, casting everything you see, the stairs, the road, even your own hands, in tantalizing, refracted moonlight, as if the entire town was submerged in water, fathoms beneath the surface of the tide.
That's weird. Explain the flood, though.
Yeah, I don't like looking at it too much.
No, I'd rather not be here, but we are. So, how far do you reckon we can get?
Morgan shrugs and says, "Let's try."
Yeah, I was thinking of going across the road to Patricia's, or Jeannie's, Chippy.
Yeah, you could try.
She seems to know everyone, everything. She's always around. If there's commentary to be overheard of what's going on, then it might well be there. Maybe one of us could pull up in the cafe, one of us could pull up in the Chippy, if we can get that far.
Morgan nods and says,
"Alright, let's see. Let's see how far the fog goes."
You move round to the waterfront?
Yeah.
Cool. You're able to do that. The building that encompasses both the cafe and the apartment on its two floors seems to be fog-free.
Mm-hmm.
On all sides, and you're able to comfortably move around. But when you get to the waterfront, you can see the fog gets pretty thick on your left-hand side as you're sort of facing the sea towards where the fish and chippy should be.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see the illuminated light. It's not neon, it's fluorescent with the design, the logo, so to speak, sort of backlit, shining through the fog. But the actual door of the Vision GP is not visible to you. And Morgan says,
"Well, that answers that."
It does. Do I remember which direction this screeching came from when I went in that direction last time?
I think it was too hard to tell because you were at that point in the midst of the entire... In the midst of the fog.
Yeah. In which case, geographically, this picture goes cafe / apartment, road, beach.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's right. And you're currently standing pretty much outside the cafe. You can see that there are lights on inside the cafe, and there are people moving about.
I'll head in. Open the door.
Okay. Morgan follows. And it's a slightly eerie sight, actually, because initially you think everyone's miming or something. Like they're walking around and they're opening and closing their mouths, but there's no sound coming out.
Mm.
It's like they're pretending. And then you wonder if maybe something in the dream is making you temporarily deaf.
Mm.
But you've definitely heard sounds in other dreams before. The smashing glass, for one. But you listen carefully and you can hear the sounds of talking that match up with people opening their mouths. Somebody comes over and takes an order and goes back to the counter. But it just all sounds muffled. Like your ears are filled with water.
Nobody's noticing us.
You are passing through like ghosts. You are not being acknowledged by anybody. Somebody almost walks right through you, in fact.
And this is my first time in the cafe.
Yes.
So, what kind of cafe is it? Kind of a Greasy Spoon vibe, or a sort of more of a kind of wood panelled environment?
It's like a pretty large kind of wood panelled, upmarket, clean cafe. Mm. There are plants along one wall. Pretty simple wooden chairs and tables, but it's all quite well lit. You know, not the like plastic seating that you might expect from a Greasy Spoon.
Mm.
There is, as you come in, a countertop which cordons off a little sort of kitchen coffee making area in the what would be the right hand corner of the cafe as you're coming in, and then behind that there is a slightly open door that looks to lead into like a back office. And as you take all this in, looking around, you hear from that back office, loud and clear in your head, "Russell." And Morgan says,
"Ignore it."
"I would, but that's where I wanted to go."
"If we go there, it's over."
"Yeah. Great.
But look."
And he points to the man working behind the counter. He looks to be 40, 45 or so. He is bald, pretty stocky, wears a checked shirt and an apron over the front.
I lean over and say, "Would you recognise Tommy Walsall if you saw him?"
"Yeah, I came here. Well, you know, before the accident, we came here pretty often. He was always there. That's him."
"That's him."
"His son's usually around, but I don't see him."
"We know he's in a car."
"I guess that means we got the right memory. Probably wasn't any way to avoid it."
"Yeah, suppose so."
"So what? We just wait for it to happen?"
"I mean, I don't... It's a memory. It's not like we can save him. We can't stop it happening. We need to find out what happened."
"Okay. I'll follow your lead."
"What do you do? You have this environment around you."
"At first I'm going to go in and just listen, if I can. Try and discern what it is that, like, Tommy Walsall's saying." You know, if he's having any conversations, I just want to get a feel for his voice. Kind of tune in a little bit.
Sure.
To what he sounds like and what sort of interactions he's having. Presumably some of them are perfunctory cafe ones, at the very least. But I want to know what his state is, if I can, read him.
Yeah, okay. Let's do a dice roll.
Cool.
Even in a dream, you are paranoid D8, so we're going to include that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I got a 10 over here.
So that is a 13.
Nice.
With a hitch, and therefore a D4 effect.
Yeah, okay. So it's, yeah, not your best, but you do succeed. And there is a hitch, which I'm definitely going to activate here. Would you be even more paranoid? I think you would. Yeah, let's step up your paranoia. You're initially kind of secure in the idea that nobody can see you here.
Mm.
But every so often, as you're kind of watching, Tommy Walsall seems to glance up like he hears something.
Mm.
And once or twice misses direct eye contact by a half an inch, you know?
Mm.
He very nearly meets your eye. And it's enough to heighten that sense of paranoia. Go ahead and take a plot point for that one.
Okay.
But you did succeed, albeit with a measly D4 effect.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think you learn. You aren't able to hear too much. The muffled sound of his speech and the speech of others is just too difficult to like properly tune into.
Yeah.
And part of that is like, it's not like he's behind a door or something.
Mm.
The variations are constantly sort of fluctuating in his and others' speech patterns that make it kind of tricky to properly listen in. But a few things about his general demeanor are clear. He is friendly and personable with all of these customers. There isn't one that he doesn't spend at least half a minute having a chat with before taking their order.
Mm.
He is not just robotically taking orders and going back. He knows these people.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You do briefly pick up on him mentioning that Gaz has a bit of a flu and is staying home.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps most importantly, multiple times over the couple of minutes that you're kind of watching him, he glances up at the clock on the wall with a look of nervousness, a kind of brief anxiety.
Interesting.
but it passes from his face and he continues working.
Does he have anything in front of him? Anything behind the counter that I could peer into? Any newspapers from 1854?
As it happens, no. But you do go behind the counter and have a look. Because he does occasionally glance down just below where the coffee machine is. And there, on the wooden counter tucked between it and the bottom of the coffee machine, you peer over his shoulder. If you were there, he would be able to feel your breath, you know, on the back of his neck. But he doesn't react as you sort of peer over. He pulls out a piece of paper on which is a familiar itinerary written in a looping handwriting. It is exactly like the one that you found in the glove box of the Ford Mondeo, except this one has been annotated here and there with additional notes that you can tell Tommy has made, because he makes another one while you're watching him. He just puts late in brackets next to one, you know, entry.
The entry, I'm scanning this whole thing, right?
You get a moment to kind of glance at it before he puts it back.
I can read pretty fast.
You do have speed reading.
I do. The thing he wrote next to.
Yes.
What is it? Presumably that's happening. I look at the clock. Does it match? Like, he's just seen the clock and something hasn't occurred, so it's late? Or is it like he has some information coming from somewhere that, like, you know, he couldn't know?
You look up at the clock. It is 12:16, and he has just marked an entry that says 12:15, crosses road for lunch.
Right.
What's Russell thinking? What conclusions is Russell drawn here?
Firstly, that his collision was on purpose. So there's a kind of a bit of a rage building there. And I think Russell is heading out the door, taking stock of the people who are here.
Yeah.
Just trying to burn every face in this cafe right now into his retinas. Mm-hmm. Almost ignoring Morgan, like tearing my way through the cafe.
Morgan kind of calls out, Russell! Calls after you. But you ignore him. You're heading out the door.
Yeah, yeah. Like you do when you are leaving a party. When you are, like, seeing everyone sort of having fun doing their thing, and you kind of have this moment where you perceive everyone because you're about to not be there anymore.
You're about to step outside of it.
Yeah. And I do rush outside.
Morgan comes out after you onto the pavement there and says, what's wrong?
They planned it. I mean, we knew they planned it, that itinerary. It wasn't just guys that had it. Tommy's got one behind the bar and all.
He sort of whips his head around. Really?
He's ticking the time down. He's watching the clock.
Motherfuckers.
Exactly, motherfuckers. Russell is peering up and down the road, like, looking for Ian, looking for this car. Because if Ian's late, that means that Gaz is waiting.
Sure, yeah. So you're watching.
Yeah.
Your eyes peeled, not daring to blink as you look left and right. And then, out of the fog, he steps, walking along the road as if nothing is bothering him. Ian steps off of the pavement on the opposite side. His hands are jammed into his pockets. He has a sort of placid smile on his face. You are staring at Ian, but you hear Morgan clap his hand over his mouth in horror and say, muffled, oh my god, as he's just walking. And then out of nowhere, the car pushes through the fog. It all happens so quickly, but Morgan reaches out it says, "No, slow down!" And as he does, the car slows to a stop. And at the same time, Ian's walking slows, almost freezes in place. To your left, the flickering of the fluorescent fish and chippy light becomes a dimmer, softer glow. And behind you, all the figures in the cafe are frozen in a tableau.
I look at Morgan. What did you do?
I don't know. I have no idea. I just wanted them to stop.
Well, good job. Cock my head to the side. I didn't know we had any control here.
I've never done anything like that before.
Looking up and down, curious. I go and study Ian for a second.
As you get closer to him, you kind of walk between him and the car. You know you're kind of walking in the path of death. You feel very aware of that as you cross the road. You can see he's not frozen. He's just slowed down. His leg is sort of halfway up, and you can see it is descending slowly as he takes his next step.
I'm looking into his eyes, pit in my stomach churning. Has he even started to hear what's coming? Is it even registered?
His eyes are looking straight forward. He hasn't turned his head towards the car, even though he's already pretty much in its path. Doesn't seem to have registered at all.
I walk straight, if I can, through the front of the car. Or is it physical?
Ooh, let's have a roll. Because you are trying to do something that shouldn't be possible if you were really here, much like Morgan just did. So let's see if you can achieve this.
I know I have to go through the door anyway. So, like, I guess Russell's been thinking about this. The fact that if these things are moving, these things are doing things, and I can't interact with the people, then it makes sense that I can't interact with what happens then either.
Sure.
I've opened doors before.
Yes, but that was arguably when you didn't know you couldn't. You know, you didn't know that maybe walking through a door might have been an option. So let's see.
Probably not then, eh?
I rolled 2d10 and 1d8. I got a hitch, and I got a 6 total.
Whoa. Okay.
So would you like to activate that hitch, first of all? It's an opportunity for me. So you can spend a plot point to step down a complication.
Yeah, I'll reduce my paranoia down to it, back down to a d8.
Sounds good. And then just a 6 to beat here. I'm looking forward to finding out what traits that you choose.
I think I'm going for, my distinction is going to be the sucker for, a sucker for the dramatic.
Yeah.
Like, I'm going straight in the line from Ian to Gaz at this point.
Yeah.
Muttering like, why? I hate that this is probably courage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it is.
Or vigor, but I think it's probably courage.
Yeah.
And I'm going to pitch focus as
sure.
a...
I think focus makes sense. I don't believe there is a dream manipulation skill. Focus is the best we're going to get.
Yep. I don't think I'm going to... If I had slightly better dice, I think I'd probably hinder, but D8's the best I'm going to get.
Yeah. Let's make this a sure thing if we can.
There we go. All right. can I use hitches in my total?
No.
Okay. Great.
What'd you get?
I got 9.
Good.
With a hitch. And a d4 effect.
Well, we're going to give you a new complication, because I'm not going to step up paranoia again, but we will give you something. I'm going to give you the drained complication, which represents a general exhaustion. It is an effort to move through this solid object, and you can kind of feel that you need to be constantly reminding your brain that it's not there, effectively, that this is not real. But it feels real. You can kind of feel the metal digging into you. And every time you sort of take another half step. It's like they sort of dig in and in and through. It is very unpleasant. So I'm going to give you drained D6.
Okay.
Take a plot point.
When I get there, I'm getting right up close with Gaza's face. I want to see what's in his eyes. And I am listening just for something, some reason. Like, I want to throttle him.
You're assuming that Gaz is behind the wheel.
Yeah.
He is.
I should have been able to see that through the window, really.
Yes. Gaz is driving the car. And as you look, having passed through at his face, also slowed, not quite stopped, but very nearly, there's no roll needed to read the expression on his face. It is as plain as can be. He is absolutely terrified out of his wits. He is so scared right now. You can tell that his hands on the wheel are trembling, even in this mega slowed down form, trembling like you've never seen. He is sweaty. There are tear ducts going crazy at the very edges of his eyes. You can already see he's been crying a little bit. He's either a little bit puffy, and his mouth is like twisted into this kind of grimace, this awful face that he's kind of pulling. It is obvious to you looking at him that he is midway through saying the word no. He doesn't want to do this.
And he's like, how old?
17.
I think Russell gets there, this fury almost churning into a tiredness, that weariness pulling on him. And in this moment of wanting to throttle this guy, as that dissolves, he just flops down into the passenger seat. You're just a fucking kid.
There's a knock at the window. Your head snaps right and you see Morgan peering through. And he says, through the glass,
look, something's happening in the cafe.
And he points.
I climb out the door.
You could try and walk through the door again, or you could just open it from this side.
Yeah, I do.
It just clicks open, yeah. You can close it behind you. Leave Gaz to his fate.
What fate?
I suppose that's up to you a little bit, but knowing what you know now. But Morgan sort of pulls you along, and you can see Tommy is no longer behind the counter. He's up near the plants, sort of lining one wall, and his hands are sort of clasped together as though he was holding something, but there's nothing in there, because you can see, about a foot below where his hands are, a glass vase suspended in midair. And as you get closer, you can see it's falling. And it looks like it's going to smash.
What kind of vase?
Just pretty heavy looking, kind of green glass. There's a few others like it on the windowsill there. This one is actually empty. There's no water or plants in it.
And he's dropped this just out front of the cafe?
Yeah, looking around, nobody's kind of looking directly at him. He's sort of near the back corner, away from the windows, notably. And it looks like he's just dropped it.
I look toward him, sort of eyes narrowed, look across to Morgan. I want to see, he doesn't look surprised that he's just dropped this, does he?
His eyes are looking at the clock.
Yeah. Well, that's why nobody saw anything.
Morgan nods.
I think I can start it back up again if you want.
We have to see where he went. What happened to him?
Morgan nods, grimaces slightly, and you hear the smash as the glass hits the floor. Everybody looks over. You hear a couple of muffled kind of yelps sounding. Nobody is looking at the window. Where Ian has collided with the front of the Ford Mondeo, cartwheels up into the air, lands with a crunch. The car hesitation, nothing like that. And Gaz is gone. Ian is lying there, his leg bent back in the wrong direction. Bruises already beginning to form along his side, along his arm, along his face.
I rush down to kneel beside him, as if not being alone could be manifested from here. I whisper, "Okay, now you've got to get through this. You've got to get through this. You're gonna get through this."
And then he isn't moving anymore. Seconds, maybe, between the car and the scream. Somebody finally looks outside. A woman, middle-aged, you don't know her, but she shouts in alarm and points out at the window. The scream kind of cuts through everything, and now everybody piles out of the cafe to come and have a look, to gather round, to block the oncoming traffic on the waterfront. Tommy comes out as well, a dustpan and brush in his hand, still looking as shocked and horrified as everybody else. Except when nobody's looking at him. And then he's glancing down the road. Morgan tugs your sleeve and says, "I've seen enough."
"This can't be everything. This can't. There's got to be more. He didn't just die in the street. He can't."
You can see somebody has run back into the cafe and is using the phone on the counter, presumably for an ambulance. And you hear again the voice from the back room.
"Russell.
Where is he? Morgan, where is he?"
Morgan looks as helpless and lost as you feel, his eyes flickering from the body of Ian in front of you in the road, and the sound of Ian, the voice in the back.
I put all the energy I can, the focus of how I felt pushing through that car. And I probably futilely try to touch Ian's face. And as my hand passes through, I take off running toward the back room.
Morgan chasing after you, leaving the scene behind and heading in. You see him there, standing, and you realize this Ian, the one that's always calling to you in dreams, he's always wearing the same thing, actually. And it's not what he was wearing when he died. He's wearing a suit. Grey suit. He's got a nice white shirt. He's got a sort of subtle patterned tie. Fits him very well. And you recognise the suit as the last thing he was wearing when you saw him in life, the day he came to the award ceremony. He breaks into a smile and he speaks to you and to Morgan, who's rushed in after you. And he says something, he says it so warmly that it sounds like he's going to say, like, how much he misses you or how happy he is to see you. But he actually says, "The monitor is obsolete."
"Who are you?"
He gestures to a desk. There is an open envelope with what looks like a piece of old newspaper tucked into it.
I take it out if I can.
You can interact with it, and you pull it out without even really thinking and have a scan over it. It appears to be a clipping, an article, and you can actually have a look at what it is with this prop.
I got a prop?
Yeah.
And for this audio medium?
Perhaps you can describe what you're seeing there.
The headline reads, "Pier to stay closed as council simply don't have the money to fix it." The legendary Kingstide Pier, a crown jewel of the town's tourism industry, will remain closed for the foreseeable future as Kingstide Council tries to find money to fix it. The historic structure was closed for safety reasons in December of last year, following a tragic accident that resulted in the death of a miner. The inquest into that event concluded in February that extreme weather had accelerated the issues with the pier's decking. A little ways down, we see that it was the death of Charlie Arrowman on the pier. He was 7 years old, playing at the edge of Kingstide Pier when a waterlogged wooden beam collapsed. A second child was treated for shock in the ensuing months. A witness to the incident, and that's redacted, declined to comment on the news. At the bottom of the page, next to the circled death of Charlie Arrowman, are the words scrawled, "I saw it."
As you finish reading, you look up and Ian gives you a sad smile, his eyes crinkling and the lines of his mouth stretched back. You hear the familiar crack of the walls. As the water begins to rush in, he says, "I know you can do it. I love you, Russell."
Russell wakes up with the words, "Who are you?" on his lips.
Thank you for listening. For more information, visit tide.show.